Greeting again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is the navigator of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, John Lash, once again on the morning of September 5th, 2012. And I'm here in the office now with my 28 coil Naga cat, Nikita, who is keeping vigil over me and checking my language and checking my act to see that I am as impeccable as I need to be. Right, Nikki? Where would we be without these animal guardians and protectors and guides? And how wonderful that the wisdom of the whole animal world can be embodied in this little black cat sitting on my desk. Just imagine the wisdom embodied in all the animal species who share this habitat with us. This would be Nav Briefing 23, and the title is Evil by Proxy. Obviously, I'm picking up the theme tagged on to the very end of the last nav briefing, number 22, which was entitled Moral Anarchy. So where do we start? Where would I like to go now? How can I dance around this enormous proposition? Well, I invite you to dance with me. We are standing at a portal now. This is a portal. This ain't no Stargate from the Hollywood. This ain't no Stargate from CIA remote viewing teams. This is the gateway of the human heart that opens into the infinite beauty and wisdom of this planet. And that gateway is now wide open in a way that it has not been before in this kalpa of 26,000 years, and perhaps not in any kalpa, who knows? I would venture to say, not in any kalpa, not in any previous kalpa of the earth. Has this portal been open in the way it is right now? As I loop back into the great theme of moral alchemy and the great question of how our lives can be different now that Pleuromic Relay is fully operating, just want to reiterate a point I made in the previous talk. You recall I spoke of our special privilege and responsibility of being witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess, Gaia Sophia. And I pointed out that in this experiment, your navigator offers you a propositional, imaginative frame for the meme of galactic alignment. And I would propose to you, and I don't think I'm being arrogant in saying this, that you don't find it framed in this way. You don't find the concept of galactic alignment framed in this way, anywhere else or by anyone else. There are two sublime realizations waiting for you, waiting to be integrated into your hearts and minds. One of them is the unique privilege of being witnesses to her correction. The second one is knowing that this propositional, imaginative frame includes the Earth as the chief agent in galactic alignment. It includes her. It makes her the recipient of relay, which is a two-way relay, send and receive. And it proposes, it dares to propose that galactic alignment, if it is to be a reality, must be seen as the opportunity for her action, her awakening, her correction, her transmutation of the Anthropos to Anthropos 11, her recapitulation of her entire adventure since she plunged from the galactic core. And all of that and more is included in the frame of this experiment, and I don't think you're going to find it anywhere else. What is lacking, and sadly lacking, in all the sincere and well-meaning people who have really done their homework in many respects and who have tackled cosmology and esoterics and metaphysics, what is sadly lacking is that they do not speak in any respect of the supreme awakened conscious and conative presence of the earth to its own experience. I tell you that the earth is present to her own experience in the same way that you are present to your experience by the power of your attention. And as the principle goes in Mayavada Vedanta, there is no gradient of consciousness. There is no gradient in the power of awareness. The very same power of awareness by which you, as a human organism and a particular animal of the human tribe, are witness to your own life and experience, is her awareness to her life and her experience. Ah, but you would say, the scope of the awareness is so different. The scope of the awareness for her is unimaginably vast. Well, the scope of your awareness is also unimaginably vast. You just don't access it. But the scope is already there. The scope of Sophia's own witnessing to her world is already there in your awareness of this world. All you have to do is claim it, is access it. You know, I was very influenced when I was about 17 by coming across a book called The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. And that book had a tremendous impact on me. I read it when I was traveling on a passenger ship of the French line Messagerie Maritime, I think it was the Cambodge, traveling from Yokohama to Bombay. And someone on that ship placed in my hand this book, which I read, and it was stunning to me because it contained an exact description of an experience of spontaneous kundalini that I had had when I was 16 years old, or had repeatedly over a period of 6 months, from the age of 16 to 17. And until Yogananda's book fell into my hand, I never even heard the word kundalini. And there it was. It explained the force of kundalini. And in one chapter, Yogananda gives a vivid account of his experience of cosmic consciousness, or samadhi. And that was the kind of samadhi. There are two kinds of samadhi: nirbija and sabija. And nirbija samadhi means samadhi without seed, which means that it is the state of absolute cosmic consciousness, but it has no particular content. In effect, you know everything by knowing nothing. But the kind of cosmic consciousness that Yogananda describes was sabija samadhi, or samadhi with seed. And in that state, you know nothing through knowing everything. And he saw everything in that state. He saw the galaxies and the structure of the galaxies. And yogis through the ages traditionally are known to have those kinds of perceptions, which are called siddhis or occult powers. So what I'm getting at is that how could Yogananda have realized that? Well, he had that experience of samadhi quite early in his long experience as a disciple of Sri Yukteswar, and he was practicing yoga and so forth and so on. But I submit to you that he had that experience because it was within the scope of his awareness all the time. And what he did was, at a certain moment, simply went through the membrane that divided his immediate limited awareness from his infinite awareness. There is no gradient of awareness. And so when you are looking at your life, you look at it with the same awareness that she looks at her life. The same power of awareness. Possessed by an aeon is your natural endowment. And this is a fact. I can tell you it is a fact that can be proven by direct experience. And so, what's missing in all these other concepts of galactic alignment is the presence of the Earth itself as an intelligent superorganism that is capable of sentience, emotion, volition, and communication with all of the creatures within its that within the habitat it provides for those creatures. And this is so essential. You are so fortunate that you have the clear instruction to incorporate this intel into your understanding of galactic alignment. And it is what you will find lacking in other people, and sadly and ridiculously lacking in some of the shining oracles of our times, as for instance, Cliff High, who thinks that we live on a dumb material rock plummeting through space. Now, whatever else Cliff High may have to say of value, and that is would be extremely dubious in my view, but I'll grant that he could have something of value to say, would have to be undermined by this omission and by such a ridiculously obtuse, ignorant, and irresponsible statement. So, here we are in the experiment with our privileged viewpoint, and along with it comes great responsibility, if you choose to accept it. It's a totally voluntary experiment. Gayan ethics is a voluntary experiment in reframing and redirecting human morals. Now, I'm talking about Gayan ethics here. I'm not talking about it in terms of the Kala Tantra vow or the necessity to take lethal action against predators. Remember, I firewalled that subject from this experiment. Nevertheless, now that the relay is fully operating and we enter the second half of this experiment, it behooves me to talk more explicitly about Gayan ethics. Simply, well, for a number of reasons, which I think would be obvious by now, but purely and simply for this reason. I mean, first and foremost, for this reason. Anthropos 11 is a human animal operating on Gayan ethics and not on any previous form of ethics that has ever been stated on this planet. Even though some elements of Gayan ethics, key elements, sterling elements, can be found in pagan ethics. For instance, in the writings of Marcus Aurelius and so forth, we are even going beyond that into something really dynamic and really novel. So I will be speaking more and more now about the novelty and the unique opportunity of Gaian ethics and moral anarchy. Now, you will observe that I haven't been speaking from the mailroom for a while, and certainly mail is piling up at the Navigator address. I can't say when I'll get back to that, but I would like to refer to a request that came in the GNE mailbag early in the summer, and that was a request for a reading list. Now, you might recall that when I started to do the talks on Grokta Talk on Gaian ethics and right action, I set out some principles of Gaian ethics and talked about the wheel of compassion and the six spokes of the wheel and talked about other aspects of framing Gaian ethics. And I did suggest some reading at that time. So that was the reading at the beginning of the summer, The Parable of the Beast by John Bleibtreu, The Function of the Orgasm by Wilhelm Reich, also Ether, God, and Devil, Cosmic Superimposition by Wilhelm Reich, and a couple of other titles that I can't remember right now. Kropotkin on Mutual Aid, that sort of thing. Now I would like to suggest some reading for the post-relay period. How do you like that term, folks? Post-relay period after the 8th of September 2012. And for that, I would suggest reading The Mass Psychology of Fascism by Wilhelm Reich. I would also suggest several other books. I think I need to write them down. I'm not going to name them all now, but I have one right here in front of me. And this book is called Slavery and Freedom. And the author of it was a Russian philosopher and mystic called Nikolai Berdyaev, Berdyaev. Now, if you don't know who Nikolai Berdyaev is, you're in for a big thrill. And he's certainly worth investigating and learning something about. Nikolai Berdyaev considered himself to be a reborn Gnostic. And in many respects, he represents the high point, the focal point. He's kind of the icon of the Gnostic telestai of the Russian intelligentsia. He lived during the revolutionary period, but also somewhat later on, and was a prolific writer and philosopher. And I've read quite a bit of Berdyaev down through the years. Now, some time ago, when I was involved in revising the Seeker's Handbook, I changed the category of essential books. What I had initially proposed in the Seeker's Handbook was the essential spiritual library of 50 books, which fell into four categories. And one of these categories, which I think was Western writings after the year 1900, contained 14 or so books. I changed some of these around and also changed others in other categories. But one of the most significant changes that I made in this revision, which never got to see the light of day because no revised issue of the Seeker's Handbook was ever published. However, just to give you a peek of things to come, I mentioned that there are five specific, tangible, and concrete opportunities manifesting in post-relay, didn't I? And one of those concerns the handover of the Turton's treasures. And one of those treasures would be the Seeker's Handbook in its revised form. So it's possible that this rewritten version of the Seeker's Handbook could come to light with your collaboration, were there people to receive this treasure, take responsibility for the future of this treasure, well, it's there for the taking. And I must say that I really like the revised version much better than the original version. And I think it has a much longer, a much deeper and far-reaching value. So it would be wonderful if the revised version of the Seeker's Handbook could be in some manner pulled together and put out in the world. But I did include freedom, slavery and freedom by Berdyaev in the revised list of 50 books in the Essential Spiritual Library. Now, I just want to propose that you read this book in the fall of 2012. There are many, many remarkable statements in this book. As a matter of fact, you could say, I would say, I've read a lot of philosophy in my life. I don't think you will find that you've ever read a book of philosophy like this. It's electrifying in the way that Berdyaev states his propositions. He states them with a passion and a lucidity that absolutely knocks your socks off. And there are many, many quotable quotes in Berdyaev's book, which I have cited in my years of teaching in the past, one of them being, quote, "God is in the child which has shed tears, and not in the world order by which those tears are said to be justified," end quote. So Berdyaev was a theologian. He was a Gnostic Russian Christian theologian. And he had a Gnostic, kind of Gnostic Christianity operating all through his philosophical works. He was also extremely critical of all ideas of cosmic unity and harmony and of a higher supreme world order to which all human beings would conform. And in this respect, you can see very clearly that Berdyaev was a philosophical renegade who clearly detected and exposed the danger of one world religion concept, the new world order / one world religion fantasia, which is currently raging around the planet like a bad case of socially transmitted syphilis. And there are many other quotes that I could go into here. I'll leave it to you, to the pleasure to discover Nikolai Berdyaev. And also, if you want to look on the internet, you'll find there's a whole site dedicated to him. This man is at the absolute summit of 20th century Russian philosophy, religion, theology, neo-Gnosticism. A very unique character. So let me just read you this one paragraph from Freedom and Slavery. You know, Berdyaev came a little after the generation of Soloviev, who died in August 1900, the same month and year as Nietzsche. And of course, Vladimir Soloviev was the godfather of the Sofianic movement in Russian mysticism. I would advise that we in the Gaian Navigation Experiment are going to be looking very closely at this Russian Sofianic movement that emerged at the very same time as the Russian Revolution. And I would draw a parallel there, that the Gaian Sofianic visionary experiment emerges at exactly the same time as the globalist world communist scam is culminating. So obviously, we would be wise to take the lessons from history, see what was wrong with the Russian Revolution, what was right about it, what was wrong with it, see how it was manipulated, see how it ended out that a nasty gang of Bolshevists, most of whom were, as far as the ideological cadre goes, of the Jewish persuasion, turned the Russian Revolution into a genocidal nightmare that became the Stalin purges that resulted in the deaths of over 60 million people. And it could happen again soon. So it behooves us to look at the lessons of history, but also while having one eye on the tragedy of the Russian Revolution, keeping another eye on that powerful Sofianic vision that was emerging in Russia at that time and that has now been remanifested through planetary tantra and the terma of Gaia awakening. And all this is really pretty exciting. This is something to get excited about. So as I said, Berdyaev was deeply versed in the background of Soloviev's Sofianic mysticism. And this is something that he wrote in Slavery and Freedom. Quote, "People fall into naturalism both when they affirm ideal principles of the cosmos and when they propound a doctrine of a Sophia that penetrates and envelops the whole cosmic life. Such a way of regarding the cosmos is an illusion of consciousness, which is due to failure to grasp the fact that the natural order is only the product of objectification, not an incarnation of spirit, but an alienation of spirit. The false hypostasization of cosmic principles, forces, energy, and qualities is profoundly opposed to personalist philosophy and enslaves human personality to a cosmic hierarchy. We see this in many theosophical and occult currents of thought." End quote. Now that's a remarkable paragraph. It's certainly going to push your buttons right off, and you'll find that reading Berdyaev is really a sensational button-pushing experience. Now, I want to point out the main reason why I'm suggesting that you read this book of Berdyaev is that you can use it like a file to sharpen the blade of your ethical understanding of moral anarchy. Because Berdyaev is absolutely right and devastatingly lucid on many points, but when he is wrong, he is equally lucid. And you can become extremely lucid by reading Berdyaev critically. You can see here that he refers to a Sofianic vision of the entirety of cosmic life. And he talks about Sophia as a force that penetrates and envelops the whole cosmic life. Well, we would certainly agree. But he rejects it. And he lumps it in with certain theosophical and occult currents of thought, which were current at his time. One of those, by the way, was the Anthroposophy of Rudolf Steiner. Berdyaev attended a lecture by Steiner. He wrote about Steiner, and he was tremendously critical of Rudolf Steiner and Anthroposophy. And what you will gain from reading Berdyaev is a finely honed understanding of how the Sofianic vision of now, in correction, transcends what he could have imagined. And so his critique of the Sofianic view of the cosmos was wrong, but his critique of the New World Order concept of the cosmos and of all New Age concepts of cosmic hierarchy and higher world order was absolutely spot right on. So you can imagine what a thrill it is to see your discrimination grow and become finer and more rigorous from reading Slavery and Freedom by Nikolai Berdyaev. Now, before I get into the heart of this briefing, I just might add another book that just came to mind as kind of a companion volume to Berdyaev. For many years, I faithfully read an American cultural historian and cultural critic named Theodore Roszak, R-O-S-C-A-K. Probably my favorite book by Rosak is Where the Wasteland Ends. Where the Wasteland Ends is a tremendous book, pointing to back to the Romantic movement as the predecessor of a true planetary cultural mindset for today, and leans very heavily on William Blake and on the visionary consciousness of the Romantics as a predecessor to the counterculture of the 60s and so forth. Rosak was a great champion of the counterculture of the 60s and actually wrote a book about it called The Making of a Counterculture. Now, there is a book called Person/Planet by Theodore Rosak. You can probably get this book secondhand on Amazon. This book is a remarkable piece of work in that it is built upon the profound cultural and historical sensitivity of this man and his profound conscience and concern for humanity. It is built upon that foundation, but it is like a building built upon a magnificent foundation that will not stand as a building. There is a huge, fundamental, glaring error in the book Person Planet by Theodore Rosak. And if you read that book and study it and discuss it back to back with Slavery and Freedom, you will be able to see what that error is. The error concerns Rosak's inability to reach the real transpersonal because he does not have the imaginative instrument required for that reach. We in this experiment have the imaginative instrument that carries the human animal both imaginatively and morally into the transpersonal. And because, I'm kind of giving away the plot here, but because Rosak could not reach the transpersonal through this instrument, through this mythic narrative, he foundered on the personal. In the same way that Berdyaev foundered on the personal, and as a matter of fact, he even called his particular neo-Gnostic philosophy / theology personalism. And he assigned the absolute value of morality to the person. And Rosak does the same. He makes the same mistake. So I'm telling you the mistake he makes. But what's interesting is to see how he makes it and why. And this is how, one way to learn what to avoid right now as we formulate a kind of ethics and a philosophy coming out of the relay and coming into the second half of correction. The second half of correction, I have a sense, is going to feel very different from the first half. I have a sense that it's going to feel much less exasperating and that there will be more concrete and manifesting opportunity. And I can attest to that from some events in my personal life over the last very recent days, okay? What is going to manifest in your life as a participant in her dream when correction really kicks in? We're operating on the view here that correction only really kicks in when relay is established. What is going to be different? Could it be different? Could it be that those who have always carried a dream of the true humanity in their hearts will now find that dream concretely manifesting in the circumstances and opportunities of their lives? Could it be? Well, we would have to testify to that one person at a time. And I should probably be the first one to testify. So that's coming right around the corner. So having said that, a couple of books for you, and they're really meaty ones, but they're really enjoyable. And both these writers are extremely lucid, even when they're wrong. So
Other books to read, you could look at The Body Electric by Robert O. Becker and Gary Selden, the subtitle being Electromagnetism and the Foundation of Life. The Body Electric is a book that would go along very well with the Reichian studies that are carrying us through correction here, as I've already suggested. So I guess I should write these books down and put them in a list in one of the crew notes when I get around to doing the next crew notes. On that topic, by the way, you might recall that I said that the upcoming crew notes were going to be titled The Central Riddle of Correction.
I might have even said that I was going to do a NAV briefing entitled The Central Riddle of Correction. Well, it's about time I got around to talking about the central riddle of correction. What is it? Well, I've already said what it is. Let me put it to you this way. There are two ways, at least two ways, inceptively, to state the central riddle of correction. And these ways might be considered as approaches to the riddle. I'm more comfortable with that. There are two approaches. First approach, and both of them are in a question form. So the first approach is, you know, how come deceitful and dishonest people have the advantage over honest and transparent people? Okay? That question is a vector or an approach to the central riddle of correction. But it's a very general vector. Now I'd like to formulate, or try to formulate, right here, spontaneously, something that I've never put in words before. In order to have a more focused and well-defined vector into the central riddle, how am I going to do that? Well, of course, anything that we understand about correction in the pre-relay phase, during relay, in the post-relay phase, anything we understand about it, if it is to serve for our deeper engagement in her correction, must be framed in her narrative, in the sacred narrative of her story. So it is in the conditions of the story, it is in the plot factors of the story that we have the elements to reveal what is the central riddle of correction. So let's review certain factors in the story. In fact, let's go back to that fabulous moment when Sophia was considering, from the pleuromic vantage point, some previous experiments in planetary laboratories involving Anthropos 1-9. Remember that Anthropos 10 is the unique emergence of the Anthropos plasm upon the Earth, which is the metamorphosed form of Sophia herself. So we as Anthropos 10 are a unique case of the various planetary experiments evolving the Anthropos. And so we know that the story says, we recall that the story says that she reviewed, along with the other eons, as she actually watched them, because what for us is hundreds of thousands of years is for them a matter of days or weeks at the most. Over a period of weeks or months, very, very rapidly, they observed the propagation from the molecular cloud M42 in the Orion Nebula, the propagation of various strains of the Anthropos genome. And these strains went out in the form of filaments that were carrying propagules, or like seeds of this particular genetic strain, this particular creature. And thus the strain came to be implanted in 9 different worlds, and in these 9 different planets. And on these 9 different planets, there occurred in each case a catastrophic ending due to the fatal tendency of the Anthropos not only to turn upon itself, but also to turn against its environment. So it has a dual destructive bent. So Phaya observed all this and was in a state of shock and amazement that this could occur. So whether or not she conferred with her counterpart, Delete, I can't say. Most likely she did. And as they were observing these things together, they put their heads together, as it were, looking out of the observation booth, and they said, well, my, look at what we did with that one, you know. We dosed them really heavy, and look at the result of that, especially that heavy dose of paranoia, not to mention a conative latitude, which comes from Thelete. And remember, conative latitude is what allows the human animal to take fantastic risks and to be, in a way, less fearless than other animals by the fact that it will jump the gap of fear if it can move to another adventure or another opportunity or another achievement. This is called conative latitude. So they saw, wow, really, we overdosed it, we overdid it. But of course, there's nothing to be done because you cannot, let's say they chose not, I won't say they cannot, let's say they chose not to go in by some avataric intervention and meddle with the initial conditions of the calibration of the Anthropos, so they left it as it was. But Sophia herself was passionately involved in the adventure of this species, and she began to dream unilaterally of how it could overcome its self-destructive and ecocidal tendencies. And what she dreamed was a 3-world system for it, consisting of a planet, an Earth-like planet, a sun or a star, and a moon. And in this system, the conditions would be given in which the Anthropos could learn how to overcome its self-destructive bias, which is due to the superdosage of certain of the elements in its 7-fold calibration. Okay, this is the story. Now, Sophia's fall, which we now understand to be a plunge, was due to this unilateral dreaming of a custom-made habitat. Now, as we know, and this is a complication of the plot, but a most fascinating one, that when aeons have a choice to let any strain of an organic being just emerge spontaneously as it propagates itself through the galactic limbs and finds planetary systems that will support it. They will allow it to do that at random and therefore find its way more or less by chance, just as we see very often in nature, the way that seeds of plants will fall into a stream, or they'll be carried by the wind, or they'll fall into the ocean. and then they will arrive at another location, and then they will start to grow at that location, completely by chance. This is the freedom that is inherent everywhere in the natural processes and in the cosmological dynamics of the universe. And the aeons love that freedom because it is the expression of their self-nature. So one of their options is to just let a strain of an organic creature find its way into a hospitable habitat. They also have the option to custom design a habitat for a particular organic strain. And that is called, strangely, the technique of narrative spooling. In order to do that, however, they have to use certain dynamics present in the external galactic limb structure. They cannot simply cook up this world and make it appear. They have to use, in the case of our local galactic neighborhood, they have to use the spindle provided by the crystalline structure of the Pleiades star cluster as a way of directing their pronoia, that is their predictive intention, programmatic intention, out into the dynamics of the galactic stream so that they can form a custom-made habitat which will then attract the particular species which they have constructed it for. And as we know, the Divine Sophia fulfilled one part of that process, but not the second part. The part of it she fulfilled was that she dreamed of a custom-made three-world system where she wanted the Anthropos to emerge so that it would have optimal ability in the conditions of that system, optimal ability, optimal opportunity to recognize, compensate for, and overcome its destructive tendencies. So she perfectly dreamed that world. So I've told you, aeons dream to perfection. Perfection means that the infinite potential of a world system is perfectly matched to the conditions for manifesting that system. And she dreamed a perfect world system called the trimorphic protonoia. However, she was not able to realize it as a physical reality in the galactic limbs because she did not know how to use the spindling device. And therefore, the power of her own intention to create that world pulled her into the galactic limbs, and she herself became the world that she envisioned. Okay, now let's jump ahead to the current condition of the Earth as a result of these momentous events. Let's review and recapitulate what we know about the situation of the Divine Sophia right now. Well, we know that even though she could not produce a custom-made planetary setting for the Anthropos by the aeonic technique of narrative spooling, well, she did the second best thing, didn't she? By the fact that she was captured in the galactic arms, by the anomaly of her epistrophe, of her cascading involution into material reality, by the very fact that she became the conscience sentient planet where Anthropos 10 emerged, acting within the planet, she could confer upon it all the conditions that she originally conceived, or maybe even better. Who's to say she couldn't do it better? Who's to say she couldn't realize in the conditions of this planet Earth, from within it as the immanent divinity, the very same custom-made conditions that she envisioned for the Anthropos before she plunged into planetary embodiment? I mean, look at the anomaly here. You know, the anomaly is a fantastic cosmic event, and the anomaly needs to be examined from several sides. So in one respect, it is an anomaly for an aeon involuntarily, as it were, to be drawn into the condition of planetary embodiment. That's a vast anomaly. Or at least it was an anomaly within the framework of her unique story. We consider it an anomaly. The world as we know it came about because of a mistake, because of an anomu, an anomaly. This is from the Gospel of Philip, one of the most famous lines in the Nag Hammadi Codices. Okay, but wait, let's examine this anomaly from the other side. Even though Sophia could not achieve by a pre-terrestrial aeonic technique the ideal or optimal conditions for her Anthropos darling species to get its act together and correct itself, why couldn't she do the same or even maybe better from within the planet itself by being the imminent consciousness of the planetary superorganism, using her power of dreaming to manifest a myriad of planetary life forms that would teach the Anthropos how to handle its own act? And that's certainly what she did. It seems like that would be the natural thing that she would do. She would continue her unilateral dreaming after the anomaly of planetary embodiment happens. So why can't she achieve, why couldn't she have achieved in the unilateral dreaming of Gaia all that which the pre-Gaian Sophia wished to achieve in this habitat? Why couldn't she have set up this world with its myriads of species, its oceans, its clouds, its rivers, its mountains, and all of the other animal creatures of this world in such a way that they would provide an optimal setting for the Anthropos to face itself and to meet and master its own self-destructive drive? Did she? Did she actually do that? Did she? Well, that's the central riddle of correction. I would put it in the form of a question. So listen carefully. If the divine Sophia, acting as the immanent intelligence of the planetary habitat, could customize the habitat for the benefit of the Anthropos to meet and master its destructive tendencies, just as well as she could have done it without becoming the Earth, then what's the difference? What's the difference between the way the Anthropos would have been situated on this planet if she had done it one way and not done it the other way? What's the difference? And how would that difference be manifested? How can that difference be detected and tested as correction proceeds? Well, in order to answer that question, you really have to become a visionary thinker. And you have to use your imagination, but use a very rigorous form of logic. Now, I've only stated this proposition once here for the first time. This is not the ultimate statement of this proposition of the central riddle of correction. It is the inceptive statement. It is the prompt for inceptive bodhi, as the Buddhists call it, inceptive bodhi. Inceptive bodhi is a term that comes from the purest or early phase of Buddhism and you find it in such works as the Surangama Sutra. What inceptive Bodhi means is that when the Buddha, the historical Buddha, or other equally enlightened people around him, and there were equally enlightened people who had the same level of enlightenment as the Buddha, for instance, Mahakasyapa or Subhuti, a couple of his followers who achieved mind-to-mind transmission so that they had the same Buddha mind as the Buddha. When they spoke to other people who had not yet received that transmission, they used a form of language or an NLP framing to bring people to that enlightenment, and that was called the inceptive Bodhi. So this is a proposition of the inceptive Bodhi, this proposition of the central riddle. I've just stated it in this one way. You need to state it for yourself. You need to say it. You need to sit down and talk it with somebody else and have them talk it back to you and rework the language and rework the syntax. This is a visionary exercise of the utmost importance. So let me take another run by it right now and just leave you with that before I return to the subject of evil by proxy, which ties in and interfaces in the most intimate way with this exercise. Supposing that the divine Sophia, once she is embodied in the earth, is able to achieve the same optimal conditions for the Anthropos that she had envisioned prior to becoming the earth, then why aren't we living in those optimal conditions? And why haven't we learned from those optimal conditions how to curb and correct our destructive tendencies directed toward our own species and toward the environment? Because obviously we haven't. Whatever has occurred in other kalpas, in previous kalpas, and there are catastrophic tales coming from the Ramayana and places like that, from other indigenous mythologies, catastrophic tales suggesting that in previous cycles of Anthropos 10, we were not able to meet and master this destructive bent. So, wait a minute here. What's going on? Does that mean that as the dreaming power resident imminently in the earth, she was not able to give us those conditions that would have allowed us to master this problem? Or not? You know, this is the central riddle of correction. And the riddle has two parts. One part is, what did she achieve in her current planetary form that would have been different from what she envisioned before becoming a planet? And secondarily, what difference does it make now in correction to know what that difference was? You see, this is it. This is as deep into the sacred narrative as you can go. And this is as deep into participation with her existential dilemma that a human animal can get. This is the absolute core of correction, and the secret, or key, I should say, the core to correction and the key to our participation. Do this visionary exercise. Go over this story as many times as you like. And while you're considering it, and while you're focusing on this kind of mythopoetic exercise, with another part of your mind, with your first attention, do something else simultaneously. And that is, look at the proposition of evil by proxy. Use your first attention. You don't need your second attention. You need the second attention to do this visionary exercise, obviously, don't you? And you've been training your second attention to do this for over a year now. So you're gaining the power and skill of the second attention as you proceed in this experiment. And remember, as I said in the last talk, part of the mystery and power of engaging the Nahual of the wisdom goddess is that by that engagement, she gives you the faculties to enter her Nahual, to enter her supernatural magic. So that's the exercise of the second attention. The exercise of the first attention now has a new focus. Call it Gaian ethics, call it moral anarchy. Look at human behavior as it actually is. Look at the state of the world. Look at the state of the social organization of human behavior. Look at human morals. Look at what are the morals of a good person who leaves others free and intends no harm. Look at the morals of an evil person who manipulates and deceives and intends harm. Look with your first attention at these moral issues in the behavior of the human animal. And ask yourself this question. Since it is obvious that evil, which operates by proxy, can have the advantage over good, which does not and cannot operate by proxy, might not that advantage of evil tell us something about the setup of the human habitat, the customization of the human habitat? Remember that Sophia wished to design a habitat for the Anthropos in which its interactivity with the environment and other animal species would give it an optimal chance to meet and master its destructive impulse. So, did she achieve that after all? And if she achieved it, why does the morality of evil operating through proxy dominate? Wouldn't it be more logical to assume that if she achieved in giving us the environment to learn true human ethics, the ethics of the human animal, in the sense that she wishes us to learn them and practice them, in the sense that fits her designs and purposes, if we really achieve that, how would it be possible for evil to operate by proxy and have such a massive and preponderant impact upon human society? Who failed? Did she fail to provide those conditions? Or did we fail to learn from the conditions she provided? Is the preponderance of evil operating by proxy a proof of our failure? Or is it a proof that in her imminent dreaming of the planetary body, she could not really achieve the conditions that she preconceived before she became this planet? Now, there's some language to go by. There's some language to steer by, to navigate. And I can assure you that by taking on that language and taking on those considerations, you place yourself in a completely unique position as a human animal living on this planet right now. And I would say, in concluding this briefing, that if you pursue this visionary exercise in counterpart with facing the ethical problem of evil and facing the fact that evil operates by proxy and good does not and cannot operate in that manner, if you do both of those things, and live those things, and observe them now in the second half of this experiment, and diligently and rigorously stick with them and discuss them with people, you hold the position of the highest privilege of a human animal on this planet. And all you have to do is enjoy it. Realize what it is. Realize how fortunate you are, and just enjoy it and really sink your teeth into it. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm doing right now in this talk, obviously. And it's my intention, which I share with you, to focus on these complementary activities of the first and second attention. And I might even propose that this would become in some way, this exercise would become in some way, the focus for the use of Channel 16. I'm still not clear on how to use Channel 16, but don't worry, we have time ahead. We have at least 5 instances ahead, and maybe some more coming up in 2013. We'll see. The moment to understand how to use Channel 16 has to come totally spontaneously, and we engage in using it at the moment that it comes. It cannot be pre-programmed, but I sense we're getting close to it. I sense that we're vectoring in on it with the considerations in this briefing today. So I want to say thanks to you all for your patience and your diligence, and most of all, for your devotion to this experiment and to her story, because the best is yet to come. We really don't know how life could be different in this world with correction. We must live through the central riddle of correction, and we must do it fast. And having done that, many, many things can become clear that have never before been so clear, and especially the path beyond evil and beyond the social orchestrations of evil, the path into moral anarchy, love, and freedom. This is the path. That opens through that portal.